Welcome, everybody, to Lore and Poor. Tonight, I am joined by a super special guest. I am joined by Ernest, a.k.a. Hollow Invective, the number one leading expert on Kuatoa. And guess what tonight's topic is? It's Kuatoa. What are the odds? Hey, Ernest, what's up?
Hey, yeah. I've actually studied. I consider myself an antiquarian of sorts in obscure and arcane lore, and the Kuatoa fascinate me. They're amazingly fractured yet mentally resilient creatures.
Yeah, I've done a little bit of Kuatoa studying up on prior to this interview, just so that I, you know, had my P's and Q's in order and was able to answer or ask some articulated questions about the amazing creatures. But before we get into any of that, Ernest, we have to start every episode of Lore and Poor by asking, what are we drinking tonight?
Well, I started off the night with a healthy dose of Templeton Rye, which I love. But the problem is I can only get it in Iowa, so I have to have friends from Iowa bring it back to me because I don't want to go there. It's just corn and booze there. It's kind of boring.
That's all I got.
That's all I got, you know. So I have to have them bring that back to me. So I had some a generous amount of Templeton Rye. A bit of gin, but then I'm polishing things off right now with a pack IPA, made by Wolf's Ridge Brewing. I don't know where the hell that is, but, this is, 6.8%, alcohol by volume. This is 12 fluid ounces in my can.
That's a pretty gnarly name. Wolf's Ridge?
Wolf's Ridge Brewing. Established 2013.
All right, so they've had 8 years to check their shit.
Ohio craft beer. Yes.
Me and Ernest are both in Ohio at the moment.
Yes.
Unfortunately, Ohio is a pretty big state, and we are at north and south, pretty much the polar opposite ends from each other.
You know, I think that, you know, we can really be lucky and say that we're not in California, where we would be 20 plus hours from each other.
Yeah, we're max maybe like 6 hours, 5 or 6 hours or so, depending on how fast you drive.
Yeah, I could probably do it in 4.5, but you know, but not while drinking. Drink responsibly.
That's true. Not while drinking all that rye and then these Wolf Ridge beers. I, of course, am drinking. Oh, you know what? I say, of course. Thinking like I was going to say Dirty Dews again. Tonight's been kind of wild. So at first, I didn't have enough Diet Mountain Dews cold in the fridge. So I had to mix my Kettle One vodka with Diet Coke, which I don't have a name for those. I had to do two of those in the time of my Diet Mountain Dews to get cold. So I had two of those, and then I had one Diet Dew all during Doom Clock, and then I have now switched to Blue Raspberry Moonshine, Smoky Mountain Moonshine with Diet Mountain Dew. I don't have a name for those either, but I've just had a lot of different, not only soft drinks, but also liquor time types tonight. So it should be a fun one.
You play a dangerous game.
It is. Once you mix it, I've got one shot of Fireball, I think, maybe 1.5 shots of Fireball left in my freezer. And I may somewhere here, like midway break of this episode, I may go and take that real quick as this dwindles down.
Yeah, I've got some corn liquor like in my cabinet, and it looks like the canister looks like a like a paint thinner can.
that should be a fun time. Before we have to take a break and refill our mugs, Ernest, you as the Kuatoa expert, what's the deal with these slimy little guys? Can you kind of give like a start to finish overview of these things for our listeners?
Sure. So, Kuatoa. So, imagine if you had only a smidgen of creativity, and you might be ST Joshi, who's sniffing anything that belongs to Lovecraft, right? And you have Kuotoa. They are essentially madness capacitors. They are about 5 feet tall, roughly, from time, you know, sometimes a little taller, sometimes a little shorter. And they tend to live in the Underdark or, like, aquatic environs. And the thing about Kuotoa are is that they have been terribly abused by the people who they have been, unfortunately, in proximity to. Most egregiously, the Illithids. There was an episode about Illithids at some point. Mind flayers. Illithids had experimented on these little bastards, and it made them mad, shattered their minds, broke it up like peanut brittle, and tried to put it all back together. And, you know, when someone abuses me, I run. And, you know, luckily they were still of the right mind to run themselves. And with that, they ran to some of the darker, more wetter environs of the Underdark, and even some of the more underwater reaches of the Underdark. They wanted protection. They wanted to feel safe. So they prayed to the idea of being safe, but they're nuts, right? They're mad. They have all this Illithid influence, and so in this terrible reciprocal circle jerk, they start to pray to things that start to exist that then empower them to have divine powers to defend them from the things that they are having trouble with.
And that's like modern day. So it sounds like they're pretty religious beings.
Very, very religious. They have a very ritualistic society, a very deep culture revolves around their communities. They're very suspicious of outsiders. And they are willing to betray you at a moment's notice if it means that they are going to, if they or their people are going to prosper. Hell, I mean, even in some communities, even they like stabbing each other if they think they're going to benefit. You know, just depending.
So are they, I mean, obviously it sounds like they've been treated kind of like dirt from everybody they've ever come across. Illithid.
Yeah, the other thing is the drow or drow, if you're feeling nasty.
With them being so just punished by these other races and things, yeah, it seems like they are rightly so to be so suspicious and, I think you said, mad? Insane?
Yeah, so we all know about Illithids. I'm not the Illithid expert, but we do know that Illithids are psychic creatures, and they inflicted a madness on the Kuotoa. Now, that's the side effects of that, is that they were able to generate their own gods from nothing, and empower themselves to defend themselves from the very things that had ravaged them.
So I want to touch back on their kind of religious benefit to being able to like create gods and stuff. Obviously, we got to get back to that.
Yeah, absolutely.
What do these little dudes look like though?
So Kuotoa they range from purples to greens to blues. Imagine a frog, and then. You stand that frog up on its hind legs, and then you put a fish head on the frog.
Okay.
All right, and you get some really wiry arms, like maybe you've been working too long and too long in the fields. And you have these like tawny, wiry arms. You know, they still have like five. They still have like five digits. You know, they have four fingers and a thumb. but they've got this forward facing fish head. With with like ridges on the back fins, I'm sure talking about Lovecraft and other people who have worked in sort of the cosmic horror department, in writing about Kuotoa, writing about things like Kuotoa or Yonkathon or all sorts of other, or Dagon, they're fish people. They're fish people, fish amphibious sort of people. They can swim. They have dark vision. Some even say they would have infravision or ultravision, depending on, what version of the lore you're really looking at. They are aquatic. They can swim under the water. They're terrifying. They're probably more terrifying underwater than they are on land. Personally, that's my personal summation of them.
Yeah, they sound so. I, Adam, am pretty afraid of open water in general. So if a swarm of these little dudes came up swimming up towards me, I'd probably be pretty scared. But so you said that they can create their own gods?
Yes. It's a very interesting sort of process, because they were hurt by very powerful psychic beings, very powerful psychic creatures. And in that, in the hurt that has been caused by them, they needed protection. They wanted protection. They wanted to be safe. But there weren't any gods that really were looking out for them. There weren't anybody. I mean, as per their history, no one was really looking out for the Kuotoa. But they, in their psychic inflicted madness, created help that they needed. And then their belief in those gods, or they actually have one big chief god and other smaller gods, and in that, in their madness, they created this god. It rose up and then empowered them. So it's sort of like, they believe in it, and it believes in them believing in it. And for as reward for this reciprocal belief, it gives them some powers.
That seems like the Kuotoa are a pretty dang powerful race of creatures to be able to just dream up their own god. Is there one god, or is there multiple gods?
Well, there are multiple smaller gods. There's one major god. Their names are, God, what is that name? It's, because it sounds so silly, because they have this terrible language. It's like block up poop.
I vaguely remember blip blip poop.
Bidadol holup.
Okay. That sounds more legit than what I just said. I said poop in there.
I mean, pulp and poop, there's only a thin, thin line between there, right?
It's the oop.
It's the oop. It's oop. I'm not amphibious, So, that's rough. I'm sure it sounds better when they're underwater, or they're talking to each other with their gills or something, and they can, do some sort of ululation. But that's not me.
So you mentioned that there's some some smaller gods, bigger gods. What, in your opinion, is the expert? Is like the coolest god they've made?
There are certain tastes among Kuotoa. There are art priests, war priests. There are whips. Whips are sort of like people who defend the land, defend the area, defend the creche, which is a word they actually stole from the Gifjanki.
Oh, that's weird. Yeah.
It's a word they share. But there are actually Kuotoa Leviathans.
Oh.
There are other priests. They have changed the nature of some of the denizens of the Underdark. Some of the other extraplanar beings of the Underdark. They sometimes worship Demogorgon, but they can't say Demogorgon because they're fish people, So it's like Demogorgon, And Demogorgon, I suppose, is fine with it, because he has to be. I suppose get what you can get in the Underdark.
Yeah, Demogorgon's a pretty cool dude, in my opinion. Do these I'm sure we will eventually circle back to some of the more religious focuses on these creatures, but just for some funsies questions, do these things have like any kind of pets? Because they're fish, right? Fish adjacent.
Well, you know, the problem is with pets is that pets can betray you.
You did mention they're highly suspicious.
I mean, sometimes they cooperate with deep gnomes, but that's not really a pet situation. That's more right. I guess you're okay right now. But there's not, they have this sort of sea slug thing.
Oh, okay.
It's like a giant sea slug. It's called a Saruyuan. And that's sort of like a pet, but they're more like a transportation sort of thing, really. Mm. You know, they use them to get around. They're a mount. They've also been known to use sea crabs to like lay waste to their enemies, to attack people. But no, I mean, I have a hard time calling those pets. More like engines of war.
Companions, yeah. Yeah, I couldn't picture one having like a fucking hamster. Because you'd be like, hey, is this hamster going to turn on me? Are they working with the illithid? I should probably just eat this thing. I'm going to eat this thing. And then nom, nom, nom.
Yeah, yeah. I have a real big problem with seeing like pets in their culture. You know, in my research, I haven't really divined anything that looks more like a pet, but things that look like tools. Some people are friends with their horse. Now, if a Kuatoa had a horse, one, they'd probably eat it. But if they had a horse-like thing, they probably it's a thing to be used to make good on some sort of action.
So you just mentioned eating horses, and I did mention eating hamsters. That brings me to my next question of what do these things eat?
Well, it's funny. They are able to eat a lot of things. They're able to eat people, each other, dark gnomes, the slugs, crabs, anything they can really get their hands on because... even though they're fish people with opposable thumbs, which is terrifying, and they also, they have teeth.
I've seen pictures. They have sharp teeth.
Yeah, the teeth are just in there, and, like, they can just, they can just nom down and just om nom nom, so, like, it's really anything they get their hands on. Anything they can really get their hands on. I mean... in lean times, of course, there's kelp and shrimp and other things, and some of the mushrooms that grow in the Underdark. But, when they're raiding, you might find that a Kuatoa might like you for dinner. No date, just meal.
Yeah. So, speaking of them having sharp teeth and what they eat, do they have any kind of natural predators? Because I think Kuatoa, I mean, they don't. Okay. I want to word this correctly. I don't think they look tasty, but I think they would be tasty, if that makes sense. So do they have any kind of natural predators that are trying to get down on some fish sticks?
I think that Kuatoa's natural predators consist of their enemies. I think that in sort of an ecological like environment, their direct enemies in competition for either resources or just direct spite functions as any sort of natural predator would in any other environment.
All right. So pretty much anybody that has any kind of beef with them, if they kill them, they're probably going to eat them too because they look so dang tasty.
Except for the illithids. The illithids would probably... The illithids probably would just kill them spitefully because they probably don't see much brain value in the Kuatoa.
I think that checks out. I think they'd probably, like, just scientifically speaking, probably be, pretty smaller brain mass. Not to any fault of their own, but just to the sheer psychic torture they've put up with for a millennia.
Right. So, I don't think the illithids are really... you know, eating them so much as just, you know, giving them what they would probably feel has comeuppance. But, you know, I mean, elephants think everything is comeuppance because, you know, they're paranoid too.
Hey, I think comeuppance may have been a word I was looking for in Doomclock a couple hours ago. So I want to snip that and just edit it into Doomclock. All right, cool. Anyway.
Comeuppance.
Talking, I want to talk about, I guess I don't want to talk about this, but I think we have to. My producer is saying that we've got to answer this question. I don't want to.
Okay.
But,
that's why I'm here.
Just talking birds and the bees, or birds and the fish, or fish and the bees. Okay. How do these things make babies?
All right. So, they're similar to fish in that way. They are like females, femme-typed kuotoa lay eggs in pools, and they're fertilized by males, and they can grow up as little tadpoles or fish sort of looking things.
Oh,
now there is a different way that they can breed. Because I know what you're getting at. I know what your producers are getting at.
Yeah.
Kuotoa are quite capable of interbreeding with humans. To produce... Oh.
Tritons? Is that how tritons come about?
The offspring of Kuotoa and humans are actually very similar to just a very plain human, except for maybe some gills. Because that allows the Kuotoa to have an agent in human society.
Yeah. We just need to do that kind of blanket statement about them. The males fertilize the eggs of the females. That's all we need. We don't need to delve any further, like how the males fertilize or whatever. Anyway, What are some, like, the common, so, you know, like human names like Ted, Adam, Ernest, right. What are some of the common Kuotoa names, and do you have any, like, favorites?
Well, you know, there's Shusha the Awakened.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. There's Noga, there's Kurapop, there are several Kuotoa. The Kuotoa actually, before they were ruined, had a very powerful arcane tradition in times past. They had cities above the ground, and they had the city of Luashar.
So it sounds like just an uneducated human brain. It sounds like it's just like random letters thrown together.
Yeah, you know, it does just sound like a lot of letters thrown together. You have to think about, you know, what, like, you know, what vowel sounds would be, and what sort of, like, sounds that would be produced by a fish-like creature who could, you know, ululate, underwater. You know, they're speaking to each other with more vibrating voices. And so things like Ernest, you know, would probably seem very just kind of clipped and ridiculous. You know, why would I not, you know, you've got giddles and you're
like, yeah, if I'm in a swimming pool or something, and I'm trying to talk to somebody that's also underwater, I can pretty much make like three different letter sounds. I could go all like, and I guess right. They just carry that back up to the surface.
Yeah, you know, I feel that in my studies I've come across not a ton of direct land dwelling Kuotoa, but. They sort of have this thing as they, you know, it's almost like an impediment because this isn't their native environment.
Yeah, I'm sure they were probably before the asshole illithids came and kicked their shit in to make them go down to the Underdark. They're probably like mostly water dwelling creatures. I mean, at least that's what they look like they would be.
Well, they. So, Kuotoa history is complex. They they actually had a very complex and very learned, very storied beginnings. They actually weren't, according to some scholars I've conversed with, they actually weren't always amphibious. But they actually evolved amphibious traits over time, and their water actually went under, their empire eventually went underwater due to skirmishes with sea elves.
Dang, so it sounds like the Kuotoa are just getting attacked by so many different factions from the get-go. Like, they didn't even stand a chance.
Yeah, they were just living their lives, and then suddenly sea elves, illithids, eldritch monsters, aboliths, and eventually, you know, the degradation under the illithids was really what broke it. They were being inbred, and there were other creatures that were doing rituals to try and exact some type of price for their own gods. And now the Kuotoa who we have now, they're mad. They have gods. They have a god they've created in their own madness. And since they believe this is just a god who existed, because they didn't, there was no god before. There were other gods, but there weren't Kuotoa gods before their god just arrived out of their madness. And now, but they believe, oh, this is the god we had all the time. We prayed and here it was. So they're doing dark rituals to it, to empower it, to empower themselves. They don't see it that way. They see it as religious devotion. But it's, it's really, really strange feedback.
How many Kuotoa tend to live like in a community together?
Well, it really depends. You can see anywhere between a very, very small group, almost like a thorp. Really, if you were to use like land terms, maybe like 10, or you can see hundreds of Kuotoa. But they try to stay out of sight for at least the very big ones, because they don't want to be attacked randomly. They want to live their lives, and they do want to raid sometimes if they see a chance, because they still have that spirit of domineering inside of them.
I want to kind of pivot back a little bit more to more the religious sect of the Kuotoa, because I feel like that's so... It's so interesting to me, like how they can like just kind of like dream up their own gods, and it seems like the Kuotoa are actually a pretty powerful faction in D&D and D&D 5e, especially like just being able to dream up their own god. So if you had to pick like the coolest god that you think that they dreamt up, like who would be your favorite?
You know, I think that their chief god is actually very interesting. Their chief god serves as a sort of a mother figure. So, you know, you're looking at this from like a mythological standpoint, from a creation myth slash, you know, classic mythology standpoint. Because myth is a way to look at the world through the eyes of a group of people to understand their societal values, the things they hope for, the things they fear, the way that they understand reality around themselves. So for me, interestingly enough, their chief god is femme aspected, and it's a mother figure. And to give a description, it's a unbelievably tall, nude human-esque looking woman with a lobster's head and some claws.
Oh, dang, that sounds terrifying.
And she is filled with the rage of the pain that her children have suffered. She embodies... she embodies their pain, their suffering, their enmity towards other people. There's so much to unpack there. Just their need for, you know, their need for succor, their need for their need for a promise, their need for hope, their need for comfort. And enough of them prayed together, and sought this mother figure, and then it came.
Yeah, I don't really question her kind of doubts and fears and motivations, considering what the Kuo-Toa have been through, and her fearing and being angry about their persecutions throughout all of time, it sounds like, from Illithid to sea elves to humans to everybody that have just kind of drow. It sounds like they've literally were just like on the surface, got driven down from the Illithid and the humans and the sea elves, driven down to the Underdark, get down to the Underdark, and then just drow, just like, you know what, I fucking hate you guys too. And then drove them more mad, more, and hunted them down more. I'm kind of on team Big Lobster Lady. And I agree that I would also be angry if I was these little cute fish guys, Scott.
Yeah, she's incredibly angry. She's incredibly mercurial. She embodies she is myth born from madness, because she embodies a lot of the suspicion, a lot of the hatred, a lot of the unsurety, a lot of the actual madness. There is said to be great madness in her eyes, if you were to look too deep.
Before this interview, if I would probably say 9 out of 10 people probably that haven't listened to this episode and haven't actually studied Kuo-Toa before would probably say that Kuo-Toa are just like the goofy, funny fish people, right? Like, they probably don't really know this, like, tortured backstory about them, and like, they probably think, like, oh, you know, they're, you know, I think a lot of people might know, like, Kuo-Toa are pretty, like, I think the word is, like, insane or crazy, but I don't think people, like, know, like, why, which is actually a pretty deep-seated reason of why they're like that, and it's because they've just been hunted and pretty much like massacred by, or at least subjugated by, every single race in D&D that they've came across.
Right. It's been a harrowing time. And, you know, it's you know, coming from a, you know, for them to go from a very learned, to a very literate society, where they actually had a tradition of wizardry to,
oh shit,
to this very primal tribal feudal society now is it's sad.
It's weird because what we usually do on this show is leave off on a general kind of tip for if you could only give an adventuring party, say there's a party of four actual D&D players that are about to encounter whatever the subject of the evening is, what would your tip be?
I'd run like hell. I'll tell you why. Their madness is contagious.
Oh, is it?
Yes. A long enough time exposed to Kuo-Toa, and it actually affects you with a piece of their madness. So I would just leave. I would simply leave.
Oh. Well, you know why that's so fun for me? Is because in Campaign 2 of Half-Ready Heroes, one of the players is a Kuo-Toa. So that is going to be very interesting to see how that is going to play out. But yeah, you heard it here from the expert on Kuo-Toa. If you're a player in D&D campaign, you come across a couple of Kuo-Toa, you should probably just leave. I've thrown a couple of Kuo-Toa at my players before, and it's always gone pretty bad pretty quick. So I agree with Ernest. You should just leave. And with that last setting, sad piece of advice to run.
Just run.
Yeah, just run. Ernest, let's start to wrap things up. Where can people find you at when you're not just studying up on Kuotoas all day?
Well, when I'm not studying Kuotoas, I'm Hollow Invective. You can find me on Twitter at Hollow Invective. You can also find me with the Majestic Goose Network. And I am starting a Shiver game of my own, calling it Aeon Archives, which is going to be Warehouse 13 inspired. Or Warehouse 13 SCP inspired, but because I feel like that Shiver has a very lends itself well to episodic TV or things that are based around episodic TV.
Yes. Yeah, that's awesome. I cannot wait to see more and more Shiver content out in the world. And I think that like as people and us, we make more content for Shiver, I think that it will grow in popularity because I think it's a very good system. I like it a lot. So it's exciting. You can find Ernest also on Doom Clock with me as a director, as it's called in Shiver. We actually just right before this episode recorded our third hunt, which will be episodes 5 and 6 on the podcast, I believe, if I'm doing math right. It's a very fun horror comedy, time traveling adventure where Ernest and Danny and Jeremy and Joe are all players, and it's my second ever homebrew campaign, so go ahead and check that out. Give us a 5-star rating and review on that show and this show if you haven't yet. And if you haven't yet, give us a review on the show. What are you waiting for? It's like episode like 10 or 11 now. We're getting up there, so go do that. Check out Halfway to Heroes because Halfway to Heroes Campaign 2, there will be a Kuotoa in it. So listen to Ernest's advice and check out what will follow on Campaign 2 and how things go. And with that, remember that at least probably half of what we talked about tonight is probably true. So thank you all, and we'll see you all later. Bye, everybody.
Way to Heroes. Darker, grittier, and much more dignified than Campaign 1.
We see the Forever Storm, a 50-mile-wide storm centered on the Severed Key. Though dangerous, it is vital to the survival of nearly every being in this slice of pizzazz. This force of energy is...
I forgot the name. For
you motherfuckers!
I forgot the name. Pizzazz or
bizzazz?
Pizzazz. It sounded like he said pizzazz.
It's supposed to be bizzazz or whatever.
You know what? I knew that was gonna happen.
I forgot all about it, dude.
Okay, maybe not. But either way, join us every other Tuesday wherever you get your podcast as we start a brand new story featuring four monsters that have put aside their differences if they're to stop the armies of men once and for all.